Hello and welcome to the Boag World Show, the longest running web design podcast where we look at user experience design, conversion optimization and working in the web. On this week's show, we discuss how to promote your work to colleagues, when and how to offer a discount as a web design agency or freelancer, and why form analysis tools are my new favorite kind of app. My name is Paul Boag and I am here as always with Marcus. Hello, how are you doing, Marcus?
I'm not bad, Paul, but I'm here, but I'm not really here. I know this is going out in the middle of January, but hey, let's not pretend. It's Christmas time and I'm just like, la la la.
This is literally my last day before Christmas. and I don't give a flying anything about anything, if I'm honest with you. And I'm giving a workshop.
And thanks very much. Bye.
Yeah, yeah. What's particularly worrying, I mean, people listening to this are getting it for free. You know, they're not paying for it. This afternoon, last thing I've got to do before I go on holiday is run a workshop for Sony PlayStation. I'm just going to be checked out. They're going to get my B game, which is a bit crap, isn't it? When you're talking to Sony.
That's not very well planned, is it, Paul? But never mind.
It wasn't me.
Yeah. At least I haven't got any. I haven't got any client meetings now between now and when I break up from school.
Oh, we were having this conversation in the Agency Academy yesterday about was it on the Slack channel? I can't remember, one of the other. Where we were talking about like companies that make people work through to Christmas Eve and what's the point, because like nothing ever gets done and nobody's around. But somebody did say something that I do agree with, which was, well, it's kind of a good time to catch up on all the crappy admin stuff with no interruptions.
Absolutely.
So I accept that. But I always thought Chris was very Scrooge by making us work on Christmas Eve, in my opinion. You can tell him that.
That's a bit harsh, basically, because, I mean, this is now official, Paul, but for many, mm-hmm. many years, we used to wait until the hottest day of the summer to announce that the time between Christmas and the New Year, which is normally 3 days, would be free, you know, free holiday. Now that's official, so everyone just gets that. But I think it's slightly to do with client expectations as well. Yeah, I mean, I've said to all our sort of really important clients, look, if anything goes down on December the 28th, just phone me and we'll deal. But I think if they're working, if there is a presence in your clients until Christmas Eve, then they kind of should be, from our perspective as well, is my way of thinking. Chris has already taken next Monday and Tuesday off, so I feel, as other boss man, that I should be in around. I'm not going to do much.
No.
But I'm quite happy to be around, and I'll be just tidying things up, really. I've got some new Headscape website content to write, which has been on my list of things to do for about a year.
Yeah. So, and I do agree, it is quite good for that kind of stuff. I'm just, let's be honest. I will take any opportunity off of work that I possibly can, unless you're listening to this and you're a potential client, in which case I'm very diligent and will put your project before anything else.
Before all the other clients. Oh shit, he didn't throw it up.
Shit, now you can't win, can you? I think 30th of January is where you've given up on all your dreams for life, isn't it? That's like New Year's resolutions have gone out the window. The spring is too far away still, and you just feel flipping miserable.
Well, On the 30th of January, I will be rushing down the slopes of St. Anton, Austria. We either do first week of February, last week of January. So yes, I'm very excited when this is going out. And it just breaks up that really, really bad time. Because I spend all of January being excited. I'm going on holiday, woohoo! You know, it's just so much fun. It's just basically being a big kid. You're going to be a big kid for a week.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah.
The skiing bit is being a kid, and then just sort of adult kid is mucking about in bars for hours on end and then passing out and then doing it again the next day. It's brilliant.
That does sound really fun. Very fun. But no, I don't get to go anywhere until March, because that's when we're going back out to the States again. So okay. I've got to wait through the grisly winter.
Really yeah, bad. Somebody said that in Headscape. They said, why is Paul here now? Why is he here from like December, January, family. And February? The family. shittiest time of the year. You know, what are you here for? But yeah,
because we can't leave our daughter and my mother-in-law over Christmas. So we have to sit through the misery that is British weather. Yeah. So it sucks. I think we're getting pretty close to our daughter not actually coming home for Christmas, which is terrible to go, because we don't need to be home every year for the mother-in-law. But this year, it's the first year after her husband has died. So it felt like...
That's kind of fair. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty reasonable.
It is really, isn't it? Anyway, let's talk about apps.
All right then. I was enjoying talking about skiing and pretending it's the new year. Oh, go on then.
I know.
My heart sank when I was reading the notes. Form analysis tools, how boring. But then I read it and thought, actually, no, these look really interesting. Well, not really interesting is a bit strong, but really useful.
So, yeah. Yes,
tell all the listeners.
I've only just discovered these, to be honest. I can't remember how it came about. I basically stumbled across these relatively recently, which is a bugger because I could have really done with them last year. So I do quite a lot of conversion rate optimization work on websites. And I was working with one client and they had this incredibly convoluted form for inquiries, and they were moaning that the form wasn't converting, and it was asking for their inside leg measurements and all of this kind of crap on it, and including things like you have to give us your business email address, you can't get use a Gmail or anything like that, and the validation software for this was a nightmare because, for example, wouldn't allow BOAG World for some reason, and all of these kind of various crapness in the form, but they really wanted data to prove it because they wouldn't take my word for this blindingly obvious fact that is well researched within the UX industry. They wanted specific data for their specific form because basically they didn't want to do it. So what I ended up, what I needed is something to understand the breakdown of filling in the forms. But I didn't know these tools existed, right? And so what I ended up having to do is split the form into steps, so it became a three-step process. So I can say, look, a big percentage of people are happy to give you their email address, although, whatever, with the validation thing, we had to do that in another way. But they're not happy to give you this information on step two, and they drop out. But what I could have done with is one of these three tools. There's one called MouseFlow. There's one called Zuko, and I don't know, how would you say that last one? Exatom. Exatom?
I'm not looking.
Doesn't matter. They'll be in the show notes anyway.
Exatom.
Oh, it's Atom. Yeah, you're right. Exatom. So we'll put a link in the show notes so you can get to those at boag.world/this is 011. But yeah, these basically will track people's interaction with these different fields. So you can see, how long they've spent on a field, whether they've abandoned on a certain field, all this kind of useful data to actually start optimizing those fields. Because this is a really common problem that, UX designers come across all the time, which is that marketers want all kinds of information on the form. And every field on the form reduces your conversion level. So now you can actually prove it. Now, I haven't tried any of these myself because I've literally only just found out about these tools. But Zuko looked particularly interesting out of the three. If you're going to check out
one. I agree.
Yeah, it looked like the best.
What error messages are being shown and how often? How useful is that?
Yeah.
That's just going to help, maybe not for removing fields, like to reduce the form's complexity, but it's going to show you, it's going to help you with the wording of the questions. People don't understand this, so they keep putting the wrong thing in. It's fantastic.
Also, that validation is a great example. So, like, you know, with postcodes or telephone numbers, with postcodes, it's like, oh, do they need it to be uppercase? Or do they need space? And all that business. You know, what was his name? Michael McIntyre does an incredibly funny little stand-up on form fields. What is booking? Booking your ticket to go and see him.
That's it.
And about the nightmare of you know, filling all these forms in and stuff. And he's very funny. I particularly like his thing about the country drop-down lists. You go into the local cinema and the country drop-down list includes, you know...
It starts with Albania.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's like, how many people from Albania are thinking, I am going to fly across to the UK to watch Avengers in my local cinema? Yeah. So Zuko looked the most interesting. It's very reasonably priced, which I liked.
That's what I was like, really? Maybe I'm out of touch. I thought, blimey, that's expensive.
Well, Zuko is the cheapest of the three.
Well, maybe I was looking at another one. I'm looking at it again.
Yeah.
I suppose £80 a month for up to 10,000 form sessions.
Yeah, but to be honest, 5,000 form sessions is probably enough for most people, isn't it? If you think about it, you know. So that's only £40 a month.
I thought it was like on, or maybe it was on another one. It sort of jumped from, you know, next to nothing, but for overall to really expensive, like for hundreds of pounds a month. And I thought, woo, that's really expensive.
But that's the thing. This is where they get, you see, the problem with the other two, and you see this a lot in apps, is because they started offering a lot of additional features. So not to do with form analysis, but to do with other stuff. So the other two offer all this kind of other stuff that I'm not interested in. I just want form analysis probably for a month to get enough data to then to get rid of it. And that's why I hate it when SaaS apps start adding more and more different features and becoming a lot bigger and a lot more bloated than they are. Great example of that.
Unless they're called Notion.
No, because Notion just does one thing, which is databases. That's it. It's just you could do whatever you want with it. Anyway, shut up. And anyway, that is still cheap, right? It's cheaper than this is. So, to you on that. what were you saying? Yeah. So I hate it. Optimizely is a really good example of this, right? So started off as a nice, simple card sorting tool. Now they've got all this junk and try and charge you a fortune. So I just use UX Metrics, which is still focused on their core of what it is that they do. But anyway, enough ranting aside.
You know, marketers ruining the world, isn't it? Or, you know, people coming in, we need to get more money for the shareholders. It's like, when I changed my bank 5 years ago, I moved to Monzo, you know, the orange card. And best app I think I've ever used, their banking app. Now it's just full of adverts for this and adverts, you know, their products. You might need this, we're selling you that, blah, blah, blah. Have you thought about doing this? And can you get someone else to sign up? And it's just piss off and let me just use the beautiful app that you used to have. Ruining it. I mean, obviously, it probably hurts me more and would you as well than most people, but it's just, drives me mad. Anyway.
I know.
Rant over.
What I wanted to talk to you about as the main segment for the day, but not to you particularly, to the audience. I don't care. It doesn't apply to you.
Yeah, it's all completely irrelevant today anyway, because it's la, 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 la.
Yeah, yeah.
Just read the words
care.
On the screen, Paul.
Okay. All right. Just my bullet point notes with no context whatsoever. See if you can work out what today's subject's about. This is really aimed at those of you who work internally within your organization, so design leaders, small UX teams of one, that kind of thing. So, as we've been saying, in previous shows, it's been a tough year for UX. I think the shine has gone off of UX very much, and CEOs now have jumped onto the, kind of AI bandwagon. So that's the new shiny thing. So that leaves us in a position where really now we have to get very good at promoting our role and our value to the organisation. And this has always been the case. And in fact, I wrote a whole book on this when we were at the other end of this journey, when UX hadn't yet become the shiny thing. So I wrote a book called User Experience Revolution, which talked about how to basically get the attention of management and to increase the profile around user experience within an organization. And then we're coming out the other end. It's almost becoming relevant again. So what I wanted to do in this is really talk about some ways that you can kind of demonstrate the value of what it is that you do in some ways that I've found have worked with various companies and I've seen other people do elsewhere. So I've got a list for you. I'm going to rattle through the list. This is a subject I think I will be returning to because I think it's a very important one. But for now, I just want to give some real tangible pieces of advice. So we start with, I would very much encourage you to show and don't tell. I think one of the things that happens when you work in an organization, you get sucked into more and more meetings. You have to start producing documents and reports and shit like that that nobody ever reads. And that actually, if you want to demonstrate the value of what you do as a team, you've got to be producing tangible assets and things that people can look at that can inspire them and can excite them. So prototypes work really well for this, right? So produce little prototypes and proofs of concept of what you would like to do under the radar, you know, without any constraints, and show it to the most senior person you can find. Get them excited about it. And then you'll be amazed at how many of the other roadblocks disappear once a senior manager is excited about what it is you're doing. So prototyping is really valuable for that. Obviously, sometimes it's not appropriate to do a prototype. So other options are things like visualizing the user journey and problems in the user journey in a very visual, compelling way. I did this when I worked with the Samaritans here in the UK, which are a massive, well-known charity over here. And we created a journey map of the current experience, demonstrating the weaknesses and problems in that experience. And then we created an aspirational journey, which showed how we could fix those problems and the benefits that that would provide as a visualization. And people got it. And we started various projects around that.
I was just going to pull you up on one thing there, Paul.
You've considered this to be your role, basically. You need to do a bloody section.
Part of my role. Yes, I do, and I will one day.
Yeah.
Well, right. I was going to say, prototyping, so you can show people things, is massively important. I'm not disagreeing with anything you said.
Yeah.
Well, not disagreeing with that at all. It's, yeah, picture tells 1,000 words and all that kind of thing. However, yeah. I would say that senior people certainly do pay attention to reports that include stats. So if you're going to develop, it might not even be a report, it might be a presentation, again, show, but use analytics to make your case.
I do agree with that.
That's all I was going to say. I'll get back in my box.
And I might even come on to that later. I don't know. I can't remember what's in this list. Okay. And then the final thing with show and don't tell is get users, get clients and colleagues and managers actually completing user tasks. And you can make it a fun thing, right? You know, who can complete these tasks the fastest and watch people struggle? And it's a great kind of workshop, icebreaker type exercise that can be quite fun. So I find that works well as well. The other thing, the next thing on the list is to get people in front of users every opportunity you can. Run open usability sessions, record. If you can't get people to attend, to watch a live usability session, record those sessions, edit them down into what I call horror videos of all the most painful moments. And then share that around with people. And, you know, you might even, if you've got a bit more clout about you and you're a bit more well-established, you might even want to make sessions mandatory. So if you want to be a stakeholder and have a say on a project, you have to have come to the usability sessions. That's what gov.uk do. And I recognize that that's not possible for everybody, but if you're in that position, make use of that, because that is a bloody powerful tool.
Yeah, we use those kind of videos in when we're at pitches. You know, it's good looking at it from a different angle. Obviously, this is all focused on internal people, but we show the value of doing things like that and the kind of shock value of like somebody slagging off their site at pitches. Done it loads of times. Works a treat.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you actually do that for, do you show old ones from previous clients, or do you actually do some usability testing on the new webs on their website?
We've done both, but we've got the really good videos are ones that we've done in the past.
Previous.
You know, when you just like get these gems and you can hear Chris smiling as the person is saying exactly what he wants them to say, you know. It's great. Anyway.
Yeah, totally agree with that. That's a good tactic, actually. I never thought doing that. I like that idea. Running workshops with stakeholders, I'm sure most of you do this already, but it's the value for doing workshops with stakeholders, because sometimes it can feel like a waste of time, because you're thinking to yourself, well, I know all of this shit, I could just sit down and do it, or really I should be doing this with users and not with stakeholders. But the value of doing it with stakeholders is the more that stakeholders feel they're contributing to a process, the more ownership they feel for the final deliverable, and the more likely they are to support it and defend it in front of others. So wherever you can, get them involved. Get them involved in customer journey mapping is the most obvious one. But actually doing things like collaborative wireframing as well is a really good way. And you might think, oh, the last thing I want flipping stakeholders doing is doing blooming wireframing. They'll come up with shit stuff. But if you split them down into teams and get them wireframing different versions, they aren't going to remember what they'd done weeks later anyway. And you say you can say you picked and chose from the various different versions of it to do whatever you want anyway. But it makes them feel involved in contributing it. The other thing I do is I do things like a user attention point exercise, which I find a really, really good little exercise. So let's pick a critical page, I don't know, a home page or whatever it is you're working on. And I get the stakeholders in the workshop to basically brainstorm as many elements as they can think of that could go on that page. Absolutely everything they could think of, and break it all down. So, you know, not just the header bar, but navigation and, you know, search and the logo and all of that kind of stuff, as many things as you can. And then at the end of that exercise, I say to them, well, that's great, but, you know, and you've come up with an amazing number. In fact, I normally offer a prize for the group that comes up with the most things that could go on the page, really just to flush out all that stuff that they think they want. And then I say, that's wonderful, but you've got a problem. And that problem is that users have limited attention. And I refer to research that was done by Microsoft that say that people spend about an average of 8 seconds evaluating a page. And then I say, well, let's be generous and say that somebody can visually scan 3 elements in a second, right? So we're going to equate that to points. So 8 times 3 is 24 points. So if that massive list of things that you've got, you've got 24 points of user attention to spend. And then I say, but here's the catch. The catch is you're going to want people to pay more attention to some elements than others. For example, you'll want them to spend more attention looking at your call to action than your privacy policy, aren't you? So every element you add to the page is going to cost at least 1 point of user attention. But if you've got something you want people to look at more, you need to give it more points of user attention. So off they go, and they spread, you know, start assigning their points. 1 point here, 1 point here, 1 point here. Then they begin to realize they're running out of points. So they'll get rid of some things, but then they'll start going, well, really, we want more, you know, more attention given to something else. So we give that 2 points, and maybe we remove a couple of other things. But it'll all be 1 point, 1 point, 2 points, 2 points, 1 point, 1 point, 1 point, 1 point. They'll never really spread it much more than that, because they're trying to cram everything into the page. Then you get them back together and you say, you've done an amazing job. Look at all these things you've got rid of. But I want to show you two things for a minute. And I show them the Google homepage and I show them, I don't know, the Yahoo homepage or Bing's homepage or, you know, it's something like that. And I say, which of these is the best? And they always say Google because it's so simple, it's so clean. Well, look, Google have spent 15 points just on their search box, right? While Yahoo have spread it around and it's like a light bulb moment where they suddenly get the need to prioritize and you split them back down again and then they start applying those points better. And that is a really good exercise for two reasons. One is it makes them feel they're contributing to the process, as I said earlier. But two, you're also educating them at the same time. And actually, three, they're making the hard choices about what to get rid of rather than you having to battle over it. So that's a really good one. So workshopping. Then there's becoming an educator. This is one of my most important. I had this conversation. Do you ever have those moments with clients where you want to go, I told you this. I told you this. Why did you not listen to me? So I was talking
to... No, that's never happened to me, Paul.
No, of course not. I was working with a university in the States that was redesigning their website, and they were looking for help on that redesign process and managing stakeholders and blah, 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 blah. So I broke it all down for them into certain pillars of work that needed doing. And one of my pillars was around communication, right? You need to get really good at communicating what's going on, why it's happening, and inspire and excite people, right? But of course, they got busy, it got complicated, and they didn't do any of that. And of course, then when the website launches, everybody's like, wee, 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 I don't like it, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you've got to become a good educator and communicator. And so one of the biggest roles, I would say, of any UX team or is to educate other people about UX best practice in a way that communicates what you do and the value you bring. So you need to be doing things like writing newsletters and blog posts that go around internally. You need to run lunch and learn sessions. Hell, you might even want to consider doing an internal conference, anything to raise your profile and get people excited. One thing that I do is things like guerrilla marketing tactics as well. So before now, I've taken customer personas and turned them into mouse mats so that people abate and then go give out those mouse mats to everybody. So every time they look down to use their mouse, they're seeing a customer persona. I've also put design principles on mugs before. So, you know, there's always a lack of mugs in every office on the planet. And so now you've got these mugs, which you've got design principles on. So you're constantly in people's faces to remind you. The most effective department I ever came across was a health and safety department in Shell, right? The petrol company or oil company. And they're literally, I was doing a Zoom call like this with them. And at the beginning of the meeting, the woman said, please check around for any loose cables under your desk and make sure that you know where your fire extinguisher is. And I said, what's that about? Well, we have to do it at the beginning of every meeting we have. And it's because I dug into it more because my brain works in that way. It's because the health and safety department are everywhere. You see them everywhere. There's posters everywhere. They're just really good at promoting themselves within Shell. So you need to be that. Next on the list is to target the selfish gene. So what I mean by this is forget, never bother saying ever again, what do you think of the user? Nobody gives a shit about the user except for you.
Right.
And there's not even any point of going, yeah, well, if we do this, it will help the company succeed. But he really gives a shit about the company other than the CEO, right? People only care about their own targets and their own goals and their own pain points, right? So when you're talking about user experience, talk about how it aids them in achieving their goals, whatever their goals are. So if you're talking to a marketing person, talk about how it will increase brand loyalty and how it will increase word of mouth, you know, referrals, and how it will help them meet their target, their end of year target. If you're talking to a finance person, talk about how efficiency and saving money and reducing support calls and that kind of thing. Jared Spall wrote an excellent article on this called "I Can't Convince an Executive of Anything and Neither Can You." And he basically argues you find out what they already care about and you frame UX in that term. So that is a really powerful piece of advice from him. Next up, Marcus, is to rely on data.
Yeah, there you go.
Which is what you were saying earlier. Yes.
There was so me I thinking you'd missed something.
Of course not, Marcus. I'm infallible, as well we know. But also, beyond what Marcus said earlier, you know, establish some KPIs. So let me give you an example. I've probably given this example before on the podcast, I'm sure, over the years. But a world university I work with, they used to produce an analytics report out of Google Analytics that they sent out to each kind of faculty or department or whatever at the end of every month. And it was like the normal stuff, bounce rates and hit, you know, all the kind of page views. And it was useless information and it made people focus on the wrong things. So instead, I recommended we're going to identify some other metrics that are user-centric metrics. And we're going to start measuring those and we're going to report on those instead. But instead of sending the reports out individually, we're going to create a dashboard where you can see all of the departments side by side, right, in order of who has the highest metrics, okay? So the highest performing ones will be at the top and the other ones will go down. And it created competition amongst the departments that they all suddenly, well, why aren't I doing as well as the business school is? We're more important than the business school. And so you can use metrics. Whatever you measure, people have a natural inclination to want to move that needle. It's just human nature, right? So make sure you're measuring the right things. And then also just start introducing, I once had somebody call me up, looking for some advice. And they literally just picked up the phone and called me, which doesn't happen very often. And they had no money or no budget. And they were very honest about it. And they said, well, what one thing could I do? Because they were really demoralized. I think they were a UX team of one, if I remembered. One thing could I do that would start shifting things in my organization? And I talked through a few things and they were going, no, it's not going to happen in my organization. I got more and more desperate trying to think of something to kind of jolly them up a bit. And I said, well, look, just try this. Go away. Every time two people disagree in a meeting, just say this phrase. Why don't we test that? Right? And people will say no. And then they will push back on you, but just keep doing it time and time again in every meeting. Oh, we could easily run a test for that and say it'd only take an hour or whatever, but just keep saying it and they'll keep rejecting it. And he said, what's the point of that? And I said, well, you'll find that it starts going in over time if you do it often enough. I got an email from him 6 months later and said, really, really excited. Said, I was sitting in a meeting today, two people disagreed. And before I had a chance to open my mouth, my manager said, let's test that. And so we are, you know?
Yeah.
So little things make a big difference over time.
Superb.
I love that story. I'll forever quote that story. It just made me really happy. I don't know whether it went anywhere, but it was a nice story. Next one up, we are getting there, people. Link it to your overall strategy. Right. So whatever what do I mean by that? That's me reading the bullet point. What I mean by that is whatever you do as a team, there will be some company strategy that's produced every year. Right. And inevitably it ends up in a drawer and you probably never even bother reading the thing because it's normally happy talk from senior management. Our goal this year is to be the number one in Blair, you know. It's all that kind of aspirational bullshit. But it does show you what senior management care about. And it is the official company strategy, no matter how vague it is. So what you do now is you tie what you want to do and what you want to achieve in UX to those goals, right? So if the goal is to become the market leader in Blair, right, then what you do is you show how what you're doing helps you become the market leader in Blair, right? And the great advantage of that is twofold. One is you're beginning to talk the language of senior management and what they care about. But two, it's very hard for anyone to say, no, we shouldn't do that, when you can just turn around and say, well, it is the company objective. So yeah, that's a useful one. Next up is change how you work, right? You might not be able to affect the rest of the organization, but you can dictate how you do your own job in most cases, right? So, you know, you can say, in order for me to do my job, I have to do certain things. If I don't do those things, I can't do my job, right? So it's a bit like your manager or your stakeholders can't turn around and say, great, we want you to produce an amazing interface, but you have to do it in Microsoft Paint, right? That's an unreasonable thing for them to ask. It's equally unreasonable for them to ask you to do your job without doing testing, okay? And it's perfectly acceptable for you to say, well, look, I can't do my job without doing testing. And if they really push you and say, well, we can't do testing, say, well, that's absolutely fine. I'll make some shit up. But can you email me in writing to say you have rejected my desire to do testing so I can cover myself if what I produce at the end of the day is shit? And nobody wants to write that email because nobody wants to be responsible, right? So you can do things like that. You can also create some design principles of these are the principles with which I operate and make decisions. And you can also ask for stuff in a certain way. So for example, don't write me a long document functional specification, but I actually want user tasks. Who's the audience? What they're trying to achieve and that kind of stuff. So you can guide people through the way that you operate and do your job. Second, last one, focus on close collaboration. And really, this goes back to what I was saying earlier about the more you collaborate with people, the more you work with them, the better educated they become, and the more sense of ownership that they have, right? It gets you out there, it gets you noticed, it gets you engaged. So do things like interview stakeholders. And Marcus, I know this is one that you value, don't you? Interviewing stakeholders. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So embed yourself in the client's team, right? So if you're working with a particular team of people, say, well, can I come sit with you while I work on this so that I can ask questions and you can see what I do as I do it, right? Really valuable. You might even want to, if you've got time, it's quite difficult to get this one done, but consider something like design sprints. They can be really good. You can do truncated design sprints as well. So yeah, all of that. And then the final one I wanted
The most important one.
The most important to both of us is to consider bringing in an outside expert. Now, I know this sounds like both of us selling our respective services, right? But here's the interesting thing.
There is a serious side to this.
Yeah, there absolutely is, which is that an outside expert brings three things that you don't have. One is they bring a second opinion, right? So when we come in and say the same thing that you've been saying all over the years, that adds credibility to what you've been saying. The second thing is we're seen as divorced from the politics of the situation. So you're going to say things like, oh, I need more time. I need more staff. I need to do usability testing. And that just sounds like you're pushing your agenda and trying to get more stuff out of the company. But when we come in and say exactly the same things, we've got no investment in that, right? And so that then makes those arguments more compelling. And then the third is people take external experts more seriously.
We are experts.
You partly, although the internal teams are experts as well.
Viewed as experts. I was being facetious, Paul.
Yes. But the key there is they can very clearly see the cost of us, right? Mm. Your costs as an employee are kind of hidden, okay? They don't know how much you're getting paid, and they, you know, they don't know the cost of your training and all of that kind of stuff. It's all hidden, okay? So you, in their minds, are a free asset. While when they bring us in and they're paying us however extortionate amount that we both charge, then that value is very obviously in the front of their minds. And so they feel more inclined to listen to us because they're paying a lot of money for our opinion. So that's why external experts are worth it. Go on,
I have a fourth one.
Oh, good. Go for it.
A fourth reason to hire Paul or me is dealing with politics. We've been doing, well, the kind of people who do the kind of role that we have, an external consultant, tend to be quite strong characters who don't mind kind of mucking in and standing their ground. And I think a lot of people internally hate that part of the job. And a lot of recommendations that you've just said, Paul, although I don't disagree with any of them, take a bit of balls. You've got to kind of stand up and say your piece, and keep and be tenacious, you know, be you know, use tenacity and just keep at it. And a lot of people just don't want to do that. I'm a creative. I want to get on and do creative things. Mm. Whereas what we're talking about here is actually politics. And to hire somebody like Paul or me, we deal with that stuff. So that's the fourth.
I think that's a big difference in many ways between being a design leader and a senior UX designer. That I think a design leader is somebody that will do this kind of thing. But even then, I think there are limits to what you can do, but there aren't those same limits on us.
Exactly.
So you can't stand up to a manager or a CEO in the way we can, because what are they going to do? Right, to us, we can't get fired. You know, they've signed a contract with us. We can be a bit ballsy. You know, we can say those things. But yeah, I totally agree, Marcus. That's a very good point. Now, interestingly, when I wrote User Experience Revolution, which, by the way, if you're not signed up for my newsletter, you could get for free. If you sign up for my newsletter, you'll get it as a surprise gift. But you know, if you want that book, you can get it that way. But also there is this a deck of cards that I produced, like 52 cards, which have got lots of these tips on them. So I'll put a link to the PDF in the show notes, which you can get to, just to remind you, from boag.world/011. Correct. 11. Excuse me, I've got hiccups, which is not a good time.
So professional.
Right, let's move on. Sorry, what was that?
So professional, Paul. I know.
Well, hiccups come when they come. What do you want from me? Anyway.
Blood.
I want you to be a complete automaton machine. Well, basically, we should get AI to do that.
The whole
I bet
thing.
Those AI podcasts. She's AI. This is really us. I bet those AI podcasts you get from Google don't include hiccups.
They won't, and they'll be much worse for it.
So that's how you know this is real.
What's next, Paul?
I wanted to share something from the Academy today. Because there was a discussion in the Academy, and I want your opinion on, really, because as normal, you weren't there. Just to remind everybody what the Agency Academy is. It's for agency owners and freelancers, and it's a group that we chat a lot in Slack, but we also meet up once a week over Google Meet. And we just talk about our challenges and the problems we have and those kinds of things. And they're really, really good sessions. Again, there'll be a link in the show notes if you want to find out more about that. But one of the questions that came up was about discounting. And should you offer discounts? And if so, how you should handle them? So, Marcus, what would you have said if you were in the room?
Yes, of course. offer discounts. And I actually saw the specific point that whoever it was, I can't remember, apologies, yeah, but that made about the, they, well, I'll just recap on that first. They had offered quite a big discount to get within a budget, and I'll come on to that in a minute. And then the client had said, oh, well, we don't want you to do element X out of 10 items, which reduced the cost. So they based, so the person who kind of come to the group to say, they just took it off the discount. So the price was still the same to the client. The client had a bit of an issue about
that. They did
that.
Handle it particularly badly.
Yeah. And it's kind of like in that position, I think they basically should have offered a percentage discount. That's what it comes down to. Because I think they were being manipulated. We've all been in that situation where, we want you to kind of give us this price, and we've only got so much, and then they keep haggling, and they keep haggling, and they keep haggling, and then you think, what's the point in this? After a while, which is that's the kind of feeling I got from there. But so to a degree, I guess when I'm talking around in circles on this, I actually think what they did was quite a good thing. And I know they probably lost the work or whatever, but it was a bit of a slap round the face for, don't mess me around over this. I've given you a big discount. Let's just do the project we agreed on. So I kind of respect that. But if in the first place they'd said, I'm going to give you a 10% discount, then when they rearranged the pricing, then the 10% discount would have been on the new total, which would have made.
So how do you decide? Because I think we've got quite different opinions over this. I have quite strict rules over discounting.
Right, yeah, this is going to be funny. Yeah, well, it's a very, very scientific process, this, Paul.
Do you just pull it out of your ass, basically?
Of course I do.
Right.
And it's based on two things. Well, it's based on one thing. It's to do with budget. If you know the budget, and we try to honestly price what we think what's being asked for in whatever the brief is, and it comes to more, and the gap's a small gap, then you offer a discount, new client discount, to get it within budget. That's just logical. Quite a lot of the time you don't know what the budget is. So then you're offering a discount to basically go on what you think the price should be. Got to keep this under 100K, let's say. And the pricing you worked out is 110. Well, you offer, you don't, might not know, but let's offer, again, it's a bit of a sweetener. And we're offering this discount. And it is always a percentage because of what I've just previously said.
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay, two follow-up questions then. Mm-hmm. One is, do you tell the client you're discounting it?
Yes.
Okay. And two, if somebody asks you for a discount, do you give it?
No, is the short answer on that one. No. Because it's like, well, I'm hesitant on this one because we probably would.
Right.
But it's kind of it's not policy. It's not like, ask us for a discount and we'll get into a kind of back and forth over it. We don't operate like that. It's not like, this is the price.
I don't like that.
We have offered you a discount because you've told us what the budget is. We think it will cost the budget plus a little bit. So we're going to take that off as a discount to get within what you've told us the price is. Don't then bugger me about further, I think would be, that comes back to the, what I was saying earlier.
Because I will fudge the numbers to get them to work, like you just said. Mm. But I wouldn't necessarily tell the client that I've done that because I feel like it sets a bad precedent for them to push back against the price that I give them in other situations. If, you gave me a discount last time kind of attitude.
I guess for what you do, Paul, that's probably sensible. We tend to go, we're doing a big project and then we end up doing support, which is all time and materials against whatever our rate is. Yeah. So it's kind of less likely that would happen in the future. But fair point.
And then the other thing that I do is if I'm going to offer a discount and I'm telling the client I'm going to offer a discount, And that might be because they've asked me or because I decided to do it for whatever reason. I will always have a cost to the discount, if that makes sense. So yeah, we can reduce the price. We can give you a discount, but it might be that that they've got to hire me for an extended length of time, or they're hiring me for more hours, or they are paying up front. So I will, you know, just always attach something to the discount.
That's
as a pro quo, rather than just a kind of straight, hey, I'm being nice to you, let me give you money off.
Yeah, I guess we kind of do that as well to a degree. I mean, it's not a discount if you say, well, we'll take this thing off then, and then it's not a discount anymore. So it's quite, like you're saying,
yeah,
pay it all up front might be, yes, okay, we'll do this, but you've got to give me all your money now. But I've still given you the discount and I'm still going to do the entire job. So yeah, that one makes sense, but yeah.
So I guess it depends on how you define a discount, doesn't it?
Hmm.
You know, it's a really tricky one because I have had clients push me quite hard over price and it just puts my back up. I don't like playing that game. You know, I haven't quoted you an unreasonable price, and I don't want to get into the game of, oh, all right, I'll add 10% onto the price I quote them, knowing that they'll then want to knock me down. You know, I hate all of that kind of shit. So it was a really interesting, I mean, there's no right or wrong answer, and I think I probably got a bit of a stick up my ass about it, but yeah, you know, it was an interesting discussion. Anyway,
one more point, because I'm not sure I agree about that. You don't want to play the game of adding 10%, because I think...
No, I'm saying I don't want to play the game. I'm not saying it's wrong to play that game.
But what I'm questioning is, I suspect you probably do without even know you're doing it anyway, to a degree. Pricing,
maybe.
You use the word fudge, and a lot of it is fudging, because you know that
yes.
It's often going to be a bit of a... If you know a certain client that you're going to again, it's like we've got a new client that we will deal with very differently if they come back for work again, in how they operate, in how they price, all those kind of things, which will involve, here is the price with, a, you know, 20% on the top, because you know they're going to insist on 20% coming off. And then if we do that, and then everyone's happy and we've been through the little process that you have to go through. Some people operate that way. Anyway, enough said.
Yeah.
Move on.
Yeah. It really rubs me up the wrong way. But I think it's also, to be honest, I think it's a bit of a cultural thing as well, because there are many countries where that kind of is built into the process of business. You know, it's like, even in the States, you never pay sticker price for a vehicle, you know. It's a stupid game and I hate it.
Yeah, well, that's you don't ever play sticker price for a vehicle in the UK, do you? Anyway, but
no, I suppose you don't.
But the example I just gave were from an organisation from a different culture, and we've learnt some lessons on that one.
Yeah,
which is fine.
Yeah.
It's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not, you know, implying anything, or just like, we've learnt that we're going to have to operate differently.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if that is part of the way that they operate in business, that's the way they operate in business. That's for us to adapt to them, because, you know, ultimately they're the client.
And we are the
but
vendor.
But just,
yeah.
It's one of those things that drives me around the twist. I don't know why. Anyway, I do want to quickly mention, and it is only quickly, I try and give an article every week. This week I'm going to give one of my own articles because, you know, why not? It's an article I've written over in the Wix website, and you can get a link to it from the show notes, bioeg.world/011. And it introduces this idea of splitting hard-to-quote fixed-price projects down into sub-projects and how I go about doing that. And so it allows then the opportunity for much more accurate pricing of the individual sub-projects, rather than having to pull a number out of the air, which can be massively painful. I'm not saying you should do this on every project. It would be overkill with something smaller. But certainly on the bigger projects, it is something worth considering. So if you do find yourself having to quote on a big project, then check out this article. You can still give an estimate for the whole thing, right? But then you kind of do it through a series of smaller sub-projects. So yeah, check that one out. I think you'll find it useful if you find yourself having to quote on projects. So there we go. That's it for this week. Marcus, do you have a joke for us?
I do. And I think this is one that I probably told many years ago on this very podcast, version A. But, you know, this, I'm going back to
a version. Right? At this point, it's like, you know, what we've done well over 800 episodes, I think, at this point.
Yes, at least a million. Anyway, here we go. A Roman soldier walks into a bar and holds two fingers up. He says, 5 beers, please.
That's not really funny as such, is it? It's more, that's clever.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite liked it.
Yeah.
It made me chuckle in a sort of light chuckle way.
Yeah. I'm not really sure about that one. I don't feel it was dad jokey enough. Sorry. I'm just judging you.
Don't care.
All right. Well, you've been criticising what I've been saying, so I feel that this is my only option.
That's fine. Yeah, because I don't say anything else. I just do the joke bit.
Just
that's all I'm good for.
Oh, no, Marcus. I've tried podcasting without you, and it doesn't work. So I tried replacing you with AI, and yeah, it's just the jokes are better.
Too efficient, much better joke. Well, no, I think we proved last week that they're not, actually. Because I did as I was told and used AI, and it was like, that's not very good.
Well, there you go. Right, thank you very much for listening to this week's show. I hope you found it useful, and we will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. But till then, thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.